You're listening to the Uplifting Content Podcast with Ione Butler. Join me every Tuesday to hear conversations with remarkable guests on a wide range of topics. The goal with this podcast is to introduce you to new ideas and techniques that will inspire and uplift you. Today, let's talk about ways to live a fulfilling life with Laurie Gottlieb.
Happiness as a byproduct of living your life in a fulfilling way is a great goal to have. But happiness as your goal is generally a recipe for disaster. That you get to happiness by living your life in a certain way, by finding meaning, by being fulfilled. There are all these, by being connected with other people. That's how we get to happiness. We don't just go straight to happiness.
One of the best things about doing this podcast is that I get to speak to people whose work I really admire. I first discovered Laurie after reading her latest book, Maybe You Should Talk to Someone. I absolutely loved it, which we talk more about in this episode. Laurie is a psychotherapist and a New York Times bestselling author of Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, which is being adapted as a television series by Eva Longoria's production company. In addition to her clinical practice, she writes The Atlantic's weekly Dear Therapist advice column and contributes regularly to the New York Times. In this episode, we spoke about Laurie's story and her multiple career changes, how thinking about death makes us appreciate life and live more fully, how her book Maybe You Should Talk to Someone came to be, how happiness as a goal is a recipe for disaster, the difference between idiot compassion and wise compassion, how we can be our own bullies, being intentional about your choices, and so much more. Thanks so much, as always, for listening. I'd love to hear what you think about this episode and others, so feel free to reach out to me on social media and share your thoughts and comments. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe and leave us a review so that this podcast can reach more people. Enjoy the show.
Laurie, thank you so much for joining me for the Uplifting Podcast this morning. How's it going?
Good. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. My first question is always, can you share with the audience a little bit about your story, your journey, and the work that you're doing today, please?
Sure. My story is probably the most nonlinear story one might think. Yeah. It's, I'm a psychotherapist, and I recently wrote a book called Maybe You Should Talk to Someone. And I came to this through my love of story and the human condition. And I started off after college working in the entertainment business. I worked in film development, and then I moved over to network television. I was working on a show called ER. If you remember that show?
Oh, yeah.
And I spent a lot of time in an actual ER, and that made me want to go to medical school. And when I got to medical school, it was the era of managed care coming in, where the kind of idea that I had of being sort of the family doctor who guides people through their lives was going to be really challenging in that environment. And so I left to become a journalist, where I felt like I could really get into people's lives and tell their stories through that medium. And it was later, after I had a baby, when I felt like I needed adults to talk to during the day, when, you know, the UPS guy would come with deliveries and he'd sort of, you know, I'd say, how are those diapers? And, you know, do you have a family? And he would sort of back away to his big brown truck. And, I realized I needed to do something else. So I called up the dean at the medical school. And I said, maybe I should come back and do psychiatry. And she said, you know, you're going to be prescribing medication in 15-minute increments. To do what you want to do, you should get a graduate degree in clinical psychology. And so I feel like I went from telling people stories as a journalist to helping people to change their stories as a therapist. And I still do both, and I think they're very complementary.
Yes, I had a question about that, which I'll backtrack to in a second. But it's interesting that you're saying about well, first of all, I love that you just sort of went with your calling when entertainment didn't feel quite right. You wanted to be more working with other people, and you share the story in the book of how when you were working on ER, you would go to the hospital to sort of do work, and then you just got hooked on how rewarding it was and how these people are like really saving lives. And then in film, we're sort of pretending to be saving lives, but that was just so much more rewarding. And you've jumped to that, and then you jumped to, well, you had that idea and then jumped to journalism and then into psychiatry. How was it to make those shifts? Because I know that sometimes people might want to do a change career, but they're too scared to do it. And you've had these three big leaps. What were those journeys like? Was it difficult? Did you think, no, I should just stay here and do this for a while? How was that?
Yeah, so many people, you know, wonder about that. And I think at the time they wondered about it. And I would just answer, well, I'm either very versatile or very confused, and probably a little bit of both. But I think that I always had this sense that we just get one trip, right? We get one life.
Right.
And that why not do what you want to do? And there are always risks involved. You don't know how it's going to work out. And as you can see, I think each step led me to where I am now, which feels like exactly the place I want to be. I've landed where I want to be. And there's so much richness in my work now that I wouldn't have had if I hadn't had those other steps that led me here and kind of gave me that experience that led me here too.
Yeah. Yeah. There's so many people that I speak to for this podcast and other projects. It seems like the ones that are really doing the thing they love, they were just allowing life to unfold, leaning into their, following their bliss, going with what felt right and making those changes. What advice would you give? So there's, you know, it's easy to just do it. But what advice would you give for someone that's sort of questioning that? Were there specific, you know, you get a certain amount of money saved up or you go to people with support? Like, what are some specific ways that you could offer advice?
Right. It's not easy to just do it because there are practical concerns too.
Exactly.
So when I decided that I wanted to go back to medical school, I had to take all of the classes to take the MCAT, to apply. And I needed to support myself while I was doing that. And so I started freelance writing because I needed something flexible to do. So I left NBC and I just started freelance writing in order to support myself. And I had to live differently while I was doing that too.
Right.
You know, but those are the sacrifices you make when you feel strongly about it. And then people said, well, you worked so hard and you spent all this money to go to medical school and then you left medical school. Well, I could invest more money in medical school, but it wasn't what I wanted to do. And so sometimes, you know, just because you're on a path and you've invested a lot in that path doesn't mean that you have to stay on it.
Right.
And I think that was something people could not understand. Why would you leave medical school after everything you've invested to get here?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it's a saying or there's a meme that goes around about spending your whole life climbing up this ladder only to realize that you've been climbing up the wrong building or something. You've been going up the wrong ladder this whole time. So I've had a recognition recently, which was of just stopping to reflect, just to decide and figure out, do I still want to be pursuing this? Is this still something I want to be giving so much time and energy to? Or is there something else that I feel more energized about, more aligned with? And it's okay to stop and have those changes of path along the way. So
yeah, and to really listen to yourself and not what other people think you should be doing.
Yes. Yeah, really good tip. So you'd said that you have this love of stories and in therapy and in film and in TV when you were in that world, stories are like the main component of your work. And so I was wanting to write and create content and I always hear that, you know, that in order to make it interesting, there has to be conflict for the hero character to overcome. And without conflict, everything's really boring. And so I wonder, when I read about your thoughts on how stories are so closely related to both of that, I wonder if in life we feel like there needs to be conflict in order to make life interesting. Mm. Do you think that that's a thing?
That's funny because most people come to therapy to eliminate the conflict.
Right.
And yet I think our lives are inherently about, you know, all of the inner conflict, all of the questions that we have. And I don't mean that inner conflict is a good thing. It's, you know, we want inner peace. But I think that if you're not engaged in things where you have to make choices, if you're not engaged with other people where inevitably there will be differences, you're just not probably engaged in the world. And so I don't think that you can be human and go through life in an engaged way and not experience inflection points, choices, differences, all of the things that we need to navigate. So that's very different from drama. So I'm not talking about drama.
Yes, I think that's a good point. As you were saying those things, just, you know, inflection points, changes, choices, conflict has a negative connotation. And so I guess I'm thinking more along the terms of drama. And I think somehow, sometimes that does get confused. You know, people seek relationships where they feel like they're, you know, if it's not fiery and passionate, then it's not interesting. You don't care about each other. So yeah, we don't need to seek the drama. That it's right. Inevitable that there will be some kind of conflict.
Well, I think, you know, in one of the patients that I write about in my book is this young woman who just comes back from her honeymoon, and she has a very conflict-free life. Mm-hmm. And then she's diagnosed with cancer. And one of the things that I really took away from that experience of kind of helping her on her path where, you know, what was she going to do with the time that she had left, was to really be intentional about how I want to spend my day. So on the granular level, how do you want to spend this hour, right? Mm. On the bigger level, you know, what is it that you want to do while you're here? And I think that a lot of people don't want to think about the fact that life has 100% mortality rate. Yeah. I'll bet everybody's really glad I'm not their therapist right now. They keep talking about death. But I think that thinking about death makes us live our lives more fully. I don't mean that we dwell in it. I mean that we have an awareness that we get a certain amount of time here. We don't know how long it is. And that, you know, we should really live our lives in the way that feels right to us. So will that involve some challenge? Yes. If you're really, you know, I think that most things in life that are worth doing are hard. Mm-hmm. So that's what I mean by conflict, that there will be things that are hard, things that you're going after. But that's different from a lot of like interpersonal drama. That's not the way to live your life.
Mm-hmm. No. Just try and steer clear of it. So you mentioned this client. She was someone that you speak about a lot in the book. Congratulations, by the way, on the success of the book. I loved it. I listened to the audio book. The narrator was fantastic for that. I do voiceover, so I thought she was great.
She was great.
Yeah. And it's been on the New York Times bestsellers list for weeks, and you've got it's being turned into a TV show. Are you going to be working on the TV show because you have experience in that world? Are you going to be involved a lot in the production?
Yeah, I am involved in the TV show.
Excellent. How was that journey of writing the book? Because it wasn't your first. It's very personal. How was that for you getting that out there? I'm working on a book at the minute and it's challenging. We face challenges. How was the journey for you getting that together?
Yeah. So, you know, it's funny because in kind of a meta way, I tell the story of how this book came about because I never intended to write this book, which is, you know, where I'm following four very different patients. And then there's a fifth patient in the book and that fifth patient is me as I go to my own therapy. So that it wasn't like I woke up one day and said, I'm going to write a book about myself in therapy and, you know, while I'm treating these other patients. I had written this. I'm a contributing writer for The Atlantic. And I had written this cover story called How to Land Your Kid in Therapy, Why Our Obsession with Our Kids' Happiness Might Be Dooming Them to Unhappy Adulthoods. Mm-hmm. And it went viral in this really surprising way. And publishers wanted me to write that book. And I turned it down. And everyone, you know, going back to that theme of what you feel like feels right to you and what other people think you should do. I was offered an obscene amount of money to write that book. And I can only say that because I turned it down and I did not get the obscene amount of money. And everyone thought I was insane. They said, why wouldn't you do that? You already know what the book is. You wrote the article. It's an easy book to write. Why wouldn't you do that? And it just felt like there was something that felt wrong about it to me, that I felt like there were already a lot of sort of helicopter parenting books out there. I didn't think I had anything, everything I wanted to say about it was in the article. And I felt like I would be eking out a book for commercial purposes.
Yeah.
And I was just starting my therapy practice at the time. And I felt like there was this big disconnection between what I was asking my patients to do, which was to be very authentic, and what I would be doing in writing this book, that I would be a hypocrite. Mm-hmm. And so I said, no. And I said, I'm really interested in what's happening with the adults. And they said, okay, then, you know, oh, so you're going to write a happiness book. And I was like, not really, but you can call it what you want. But I really want to sort of delve into what's going on at this cultural moment with the adults. And I couldn't get myself to write that book. because it kept feeling like a happiness book. And I felt like happiness is beside the point. And I don't mean I'm anti-happiness. I mean that happiness as a byproduct of living your life in a fulfilling way is a great goal to have. But happiness as your goal is generally a recipe for disaster. That you get to happiness by living your life in a certain way, by finding meaning, by being fulfilled. There are all these, by being connected with other people. That's how we get to happiness. We don't just go straight to happiness. Mm-hmm. And so I couldn't get myself to write this book, and I was filled with shame because I'd already turned down the other book. And now if I didn't write this book, which by the way, they did not offer me an obscene amount of money for.
but it's already a huge hit. So I hope that you...
No, this wasn't the book. So this is still the happiness.
I couldn't
write it. And I eventually said, I'm just not going to write a book. And I canceled it. And everyone said, oh, you're insane for canceling this book. Just turn in a book. It doesn't matter. But I couldn't do it. I felt like I had to write something that aligned with what I was truly wanted to say and how I wanted to help people. And then eventually, when I thought I was never going to write another book, I started writing one night and it became this book, Maybe You Should Talk to Someone. And I thought like three people would read this because everyone said, oh, nobody wants to read about this. This is so uncommercial. And I said, I don't care. It's what I have to write. Mm-hmm. And so I just kind of let it rip, you know, like in terms of my story, I didn't hold back. And now, you know, knowing how, and it's like been 20 odd weeks on the New York Times bestseller list, if I had known that many people would read it, I might've cleaned myself up. I might've, you know what I mean? I might not have been so open. But I think that the reason that people are responding to it is because I was so open.
Exactly. They connected with that authenticity. I love that you didn't think that it would get as far as it had, because it opens with really personal stuff. You talking about your experience going to therapy after your fiance calling off the engagement and things like that. And you shared a lot about that stuff. Yeah, I was going to say, did you worry about what clients would think about you? Well, you did worry about what clients would think about you being in therapy. That was a barrier, but I guess you didn't think the book would reach.
I didn't think they would even know about it. Yeah. Honestly, I really didn't think, you know, I thought like it will help whoever reads it, because I really feel like what the book does is it, I think that we learn most by seeing ourselves in other people's stories. That if someone says to you, you know, you do this or you're like this, our response tends to be defensive. Like, no, I don't. I'm not like that. But if you're reading other people's stories and you see behaviors or patterns that feel familiar to you, it helps you to see something about yourself and to change. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I wanted the book to do, but I really felt it would not reach that many people. And I certainly didn't think that people that I saw in therapy would see the book. And it's interesting because when the book came out, I took some time off to go on book tour. And when I came back to the office, and I never said why I was going to be gone for X number of weeks. And when I came back, some people sat on the couch and said, so I read your book. Right? And other people have to this day not said a word. So I don't know if they know about it and they don't want to talk about it, or if they just really don't know about it. I find it hard to believe at this point that they wouldn't know about it, given that I am their therapist.
Yeah. But if they don't want to mention it, then that's fine. You just let them be with that.
Right. But the people who have, it's interesting because we've had these really rich, deep conversations about our relationship. Yeah. And what it has taught them about themselves and the ways that they relate in the world, which is exactly what I wanted the book to do.
Yeah. I also love that in the book, you talk a lot about being the work that you do, the restrictions and just, you know, how you can't sort of be friends with them on Facebook or certain things. It's just sort of ways of being that make it a little bit difficult. And I think because you shared all of that, it gives everyone like a good understanding of what it is to be in that world. And then it would allow other clients to be able to open up that have read it, to be able to talk to you about it. I don't know. It just gave me a lot of insight into how delicate you have to be as a therapist.
Yeah, there's a chapter in the book called Embarrassing Public Encounters, which is what happens when you run into your patients, what we like to say, out in the wild. and, you know, there's that time where I'm in the, I'm trying on bras in a department store, and I don't know that there's a patient in the dressing room right next to me. Mm-hmm. And the salesperson says over the dressing room door, "We have the miracle bra in a 34A, ma'am." And then my patient walks out and it's incredibly awkward and mortifying.
The ones that you mentioned in the book, obviously you got their permission from them and their families. Do you still see them, those clients?
Right. So, you know, when
you can't say that.
Right. When I was choosing who I would write about, I wanted to make sure that I was writing about people that I wasn't currently seeing on a weekly basis. Mm-hmm. Because I think that it's really hard for me. It would be hard to have that line between here we're doing a therapy session and then I go home and I'm writing, even if what I'm writing about happened years before, so it's not current. Yeah. I felt like it would not be clean.
Right.
So I specifically chose patients that I was not currently seeing in that way.
That makes sense. And you've got all this stuff going on the book. You've been on the book tour, you're speaking, you do all these things. Do you still work with patients? Is that,
oh yes,
have a set bit of time? Oh, you do. Fantastic.
Oh yeah. No, that's my primary job is that, you know, I'm a therapist. And I also write the weekly Dear Therapist column for The Atlantic. So I write this weekly kind of advice column. It's not the kind of advice, that I think, some people want, which is very straightforward. Like, here's what you should say to your mother-in-law. It's more, here's what a therapist, or at least this therapist, would be thinking if you came in with this problem, and here's how I would try to get you to think about it so you can come to some idea about how you want to approach this that you haven't already come up with. And I think, you know, one of the things I do as a therapist is I help people to see their blind spots. I help people to see something. I hold up a mirror to them and help them to see themselves and their situations in a way that they're not already seeing it. And that's what I try to do in the column as well.
I love that. And I think that it's a shame that therapy is not always, help is not always easily accessible for people. There's money barriers, there's cultural barriers, there's all sorts of things that get in the way of it. And so that sounds like a fantastic column that someone can go to get a bit of insight. And I'm sure there's lots of different examples of situations that maybe there's something that can relate to them.
Yeah, I was going to say, just like in the book, I think, you know, whether it's the book or the column, I think that if people can see themselves in these situations, that it helps them. You know, so many people have said, oh, when I read your book or when I read this column, it helped me. It was like a therapy session.
That's brilliant. Kind of on that, my last guest for the podcast was a guy called Flip Flippin, real name. Well, his nickname is Flip. And he has a book about rewriting your story. He calls it your third story. And it seems like that rewriting your story is an element of the work you do. How does that look for someone? When you're working with a patient, is there like this sort of sitting down and collaborating with them? How do you want this to be? Is that the kind of the style?
Yeah. I love that you mentioned that. I actually just gave a TED talk on this very topic about how I feel like as a therapist, I'm really an editor, and that because I worked as a writer for so long and have been editing for so long, that I feel like that work really helps me to get into people's stories with an editor's mind, with a therapist's mind, of course, but also an editor's mind, which is sort of like, you know, is the protagonist moving forward or is the protagonist going in circles? Yeah. Do the plot points reveal a theme? Spoiler, they do. they generally do. Are the supporting characters important or are they a distraction? And when I talk about the supporting characters, I mean our friends, our family. In the book, I talk a little bit about idiot compassion and how our friends and family sometimes offer us idiot compassion, which is they go along with our stories, but it's a faulty version of the story. And they'll say, yeah, that guy was a jerk, you know, when someone breaks up with you. Or they say, yeah, I can't believe the other person got the job promotion you wanted, even though they kind of know that you didn't really put in the work, right? Mm-hmm. They won't really tell you. Even if they can see the problem clearly, they won't really say, yeah, that's happened to you three times before. Maybe, you know, it's like if a fight breaks out in every bar you're going to, maybe it's you.
Yeah.
They won't say that.
Right.
And so what we need to do is offer wise compassion. And I think what you get in when we edit the stories in therapy is we're offering wise compassion. We're saying, I want you to look at this story the way you're telling it. And I want you to imagine how the other characters in the story might tell this same exact story. If they wrote the story or they were sitting on the couch here, how would they tell me this story? Mm-hmm. And where would the stories overlap? And where would they be different, and what accounts for those differences? Mm-hmm. And if we can start to see the story from another person's point of view, not only does the other person become more, do we feel more compassion for the other person, but the plot opens up. Suddenly mm-hmm. we can see so much more. Mm-hmm. And that's where change begins. That's where we can start the rewrite. That's where we can say, okay, here are the threads that are just an old story that I'm telling myself that's not really true. And here are the ways that I can use this, you know, sort of these themes that I keep running around, you know, in life with, and how can I change them?
It seems like it's a really fantastic technique to help people look at themselves objectively and look at what they're doing in their life and the people around them. I think that's a really clever way of doing it, just taking it out of just being all in our heads about it and looking at it as a story, as a film, as a characters and plot.
Right. And I think there's the stories that we tell ourselves, you know, they affect every aspect of our lives, but particularly the stories that we tell ourselves about ourselves, like, yes. You know, I'm unlovable. I can't trust people. Nothing will ever work out for me. I mean, these are so common, these stories people walk around with, and they don't even realize that they're walking around with those stories, that those stories are playing in their heads.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I was going to ask you that. What are some of the most common things that come up? And I'm sure it's all like not being enough, not this enough, trusting, or all men are liars and cheats or whatever. I'm sure that's not the most common one, but yeah, we don't realize that we've got these beliefs. And so you have to kind of look at it to make any change.
Right, right. And I think that, you know, one time I asked somebody, I said, I want you to write down everything all the stories that you're telling yourself. And I want you to just write down everything you're thinking for 3 days. And she came back the next week. And she said, I am such a bully to myself. I'm so unkind to myself. She said, I can't even say this out loud. I'm embarrassed to say this. And I said, don't worry about it, because most people are saying the same things to themselves. But if you ever talk that way to your friends, you wouldn't have any friends.
No.
I mean, just the things like, oh, you're such an idiot. Yeah. Oh, you know, you look horrible today. Yeah. You know, just, you know, whatever these things are, we would never say that to other people. We're so hard on ourselves.
I was very depressed when I was younger. And about 7-8 years ago, I got into personal development, and Eckhart Tolle was a huge changing force for me, understanding my thoughts. For the first time, I recognized the thoughts I was thinking, the things I said to myself, and that I could change them. But the thinking was horrible. It was, I hate myself. I hate myself. Oh, you suck. Like every time I did anything, you idiot, just shame and hate directed at myself incessantly. You know, you're never going to make it. You're going to die alone. No one's going to like, it was just horrible. And so that's so many people's existence. And so it's just recognizing that these thoughts are not true. You can change them. And so it's that not identifying with the thinking, recognizing it as something that we do and that we can change.
Right. I always say to people who are depressed, I say, you are not the best person to talk to you about you right now.
Yeah, so true.
And that's because depression distorts our stories in a particular way. It narrows our perspective to the point that we're looking through like tunnel vision. We can't see anything else out there. All we see is the negativity. Mm-hmm. All we see is, you are bad. This is bad. Everything's bad. Nothing will ever change. Something's wrong with me. So I always say, you are not the best person to talk to you about you right now, because your perspective is distorted right now.
Yeah. Yeah. And so then speak to someone else. That would be the recommendation.
Well, I think it's about sort of helping somebody to get out of the depression first, because they will become less distorted. And part of it is what depression does is it isolates you.
Yes, it does.
And what we need is connection, that we grow in connection with others. We need it like air or food or water. And I think that what happens is people isolate when they get depressed.
Mm.
And so one of the main things that I try to do for people who are depressed is I try to get them to you know, join the human race again in mm-hmm. some small way. As hard as it is, because they're so unmotivated to do that, they don't find pleasure in any of the normal things they used to find pleasure in.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a big part of it. So that once the depression starts to lift a little bit, your depression widens.
Your depression widens? Tell me what.
I'm sorry, not your depression, your perspective.
Okay,
your perspective widens.
I'm a bit confused by that.
Your depression narrows and your perspective widens.
That makes sense.
I misspoke.
So I interviewed a fabulous guy called Johan Hari, who has a book about depression called Lost Connections. And he says exactly that. It's, you know, it's not just a chemical imbalance. It's this disconnect from our passions, which is what you spoke about earlier, our passions and our relationships and things like that. And so, Yeah.
It reminds me of there's a woman that I read about in the book who's in her 20s and she keeps like hooking up with the wrong guys and she's depressed and at one point she's going like this. She's like, and then he said, and then I said, and then he said.
She's doing thumb texting.
She had this really important conversation on text. Yeah. And I said, you had this conversation on text? And she said, you know, yeah. And I said, you have to be in the room with someone. You know, there's different energy. You read their body language. And she said, oh no, we also use emojis. And she was not kidding. And I think that when we talk about connection and when we talk about this lost connections, you know, those are the connections that we've lost. We've lost the art of being in the presence of another human being.
Mm-hmm.
And we've made it hard not only to sit with other people, but also to sit with ourselves, with our own feelings. So the minute people leave the therapy room, they whip out their phones like on an airplane, right?
Yep.
Got their phone. They don't take the time. You'll be in an elevator or online somewhere and everyone's on their phones. We can't be with ourselves in our own thoughts.
Yeah. So just spending time with that. I do, when I have that sometimes, I don't always catch it, but when I have that urge to go grab my phone out, if I'm waiting in a waiting room or something like that, there's times I'm like, let's just sit here in it. And I remember being in Soho House in LA a few years ago. And it's like a very, you know, seen to be seen type of place. And all my friends had gone to the bathroom, but no one was around. It was just me sat at the table. And I instinctively went to get my phone out. And I wasn't drinking at the time either. And I was like, no, just sit here in this fancy place and be alone on your own and just sit there. And it was just this very awkward moment for a second. And then I was like, yeah, no, I can do this. But yes, we do just go to that bone to escape any type of discomfort and avoidance of just being with. So lean into that a little bit more, that uncomfortableness, and try it out sometime.
Right. But then it creates a different discomfort that we don't realize. There's this short-term gratification or the short-term, it relaxes us, right? To say like, I can look into my phone and it, mm-hmm. you know, relieves your anxiety for a moment. But what it does in the long term is that it makes it really hard to, you know, find that sort of inner sense of calm, inner sense of peace. A colleague of mine called the internet, she said, it's the most effective short-term non-prescription painkiller out there.
Yes.
Because it numbs us. It numbs us. And we think that we want that. We think we want the absence of feelings, but we don't, because numbness isn't the absence of feelings. Numbness is feeling overwhelmed by too many feelings.
Mm.
And then you have to get rid of them and you go numb.
Mm. Wow. So the alternative is managing feelings?
I think it's being able to tolerate our feelings.
Mm. Or experience, so or feel the feelings.
Yeah, feel the feelings. And when I say tolerate them, what I mean is like, if you notice that some anxiety comes in, say hi to your anxiety. Yeah. Welcome your anxiety. Instead of feeling like, oh, got to shut that down. Let me go on Twitter, right?
Yeah. so true. Right?
You know, let me eat another muffin.
Yes.
You know, it's like say hi to your anxiety, because that will actually make you feel better.
Mm.
Your anxiety, just because you stuff it down, doesn't mean it went away. It's still there. It's just operating in the background.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you have availability for people? Are you super busy right now? Are you taking on clients?
I don't. I actually have a full practice right now.
Figured. I'm like, damn it. You're great.
Thank you.
Do you still see your therapist? Are you seeing him at the minute?
I see him at times. Yeah.
Yeah.
What we like to call tune-ups.
Yes. That's fantastic.
I go in for tune-ups.
We all need a tune-up from time to time.
Yeah.
So just to wrap up with, because you've got a full practice, you've got all the stuff going on with the book. How do you manage? You've got a son. How do you manage everything? Do you have a good way of sort of balancing all of these things?
You know, people always ask me about sort of work-life balance, and I have no advice for that because
I haven't quite mastered it yet yourself.
because I feel like if you're really engaged in life, you know, you're going to be busy and that's you're going to make choices and you can't do everything. And I have to say no to certain things. And I say yes to things that maybe, you know, overextend me a little bit. And you know, you just make those choices. But again, going back to, you know, being intentional about your choices, is this something that I feel like, you know, is fulfilling, is meaningful. You know, am I living my life in the way I want to live it? And that sort of determines the yeses and the noes.
That's a good way of doing it. So what's next for you? When is the TV show coming? So the show's
being written right now.
Yes.
So we'll see. I don't know, have a date yet for that. It's with Eva Longoria's company and we're very excited.
She's playing you?
No, she's producing it. We don't know who's been cast in it yet.
Okay, I'm so excited for this show. The book is fantastic, everybody. Please go and read it or listen to the audiobook. The actress was fantastic that did that. It's called Maybe You Should Talk to Somebody. And then it's going to become a TV show. So you have to read it at the book stage because you'll be hooked on the show, I'm sure. but you'd mentioned that you're launching a podcast. When's that coming out?
So I'm launching a podcast. And it's me with Guy Winch, who is going to be the TED advice columnist. So, so we're going to do something a kind of twist on the advice world with the two of us. And that's going to be for iHeart with Katie Couric producing.
Congrats. And that'd be great.
And then I have the TED Talk, which should be out soon, which I just did live.
Yeah.
And I have the Dear Therapist column that I write that comes out every Monday with The Atlantic. So people are welcome to submit letters to dear.therapist@theatlantic.com. They would like their question answered.
Fabulous. When can we expect the podcast to be out?
Next year, early next year.
And you've got a sign up on your website so people can just go check out. Laurie will have the details in the show notes and they can just subscribe to your newsletter to get links to that when that comes out.
Yeah, I'm really bad at the newsletter, but
me too. But it's still good. Just sign up, and then when something happens,
I think if you want the most up to date, look on like Twitter or Facebook or Instagram,
which we will have all of those links in the show notes. Laurie, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak to me today. I am so just blown away by your work, and congratulations on all the success of everything. And it was just lovely being able to speak to you. So thank you for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, thank you. Take care, everyone. You will hear from me next week. Thanks. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Uplifting Content Podcast with me, Ione Butler. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe on iTunes and leave us a review so that more people can find it. And to make sure you never miss a beat, subscribe to our weekly dose of uplifting content, which is an email from me about the best of uplifting content from that week, be it giveaways, videos, interviews, all the good stuff. And as a bonus, when you subscribe, you get access to the Uplifting Content Summit for free. The Uplifting Content Summit was an interview series with some fantastic guests, including Jay Shetty, Christine Hassler, Alexi Panos, Preston Smiles, Kyle Cease, Peter Kelly, Jenna Phillips Ballard, and many more about how to stay uplifted. So if you'd like some tips and advice from some of the best thought leaders, authors, coaches out there, be sure to subscribe to my email update and get access to this summit for free. The link to sign up is in the show notes. Thanks again for listening, and until next time, take care. Bye.